Okay.
Can you hear from y'all?
Not really. Unless I change the switch here.
Okay, good evening. I'll start a bit early as usual. So our dear center manager can switch on the recorder and go to work. So we'll pick up her time. Actually today will be the last class of this series on protection. I can't remember what it is. What's the title? Protection through refuge and karma or something like that, yeah. Okay, so before I start, any comments or questions? Karma usually have a lot of questions, right? People always say that, oh, what happened if someone gets it? I have termite. What should I do? You know, I have termite. Termite is infected. And then, what can I do with the termite? What can I do with termite without creating negative karma? I can assure you there's nothing you can do about termite without creating negative karma. It's too bad. Yeah. Just have to find ways to reduce the damage, but it's unlikely that you can get out of it without creating anything negative, without harming a single someone. It's not possible. That's the problem, because we share our life, our world with other sentient beings. Sentient beings are always troublesome. They make life difficult for us. Unfortunately, we just have to be patient with them. So, any questions about? So last year I started on karma, talking a little bit about karma. So I wonder, if there are any questions. Doesn't matter if there are no questions. Yeah, I can still keep talking. Never worried about that. I have, learned the art of monologuing many years ago. And although I think 1.5 hours is probably my limit. Because I think when I first came back to Singapore and they started teaching here at ABC, they have a tradition of teaching 2 hours. 2 hours? What am I going to talk about over 2 hours, you know? I run out of ideas. It's so tiring, of course. And I keep going 2 hours. So I have all these little tricks over the years to reduce the amount of talking required. One of them is to meditate. In fact, when I was teaching in Sydney, I like to teach, when I do meditation class, I teach 1 hour meditation. Within 1 hour, we do 2 guided meditations, 25 minutes each, which only means I only need to talk 5 minutes before each meditation and then habish. So we can all go home. Right. So then, 1.5 hours is a bit longer, more demanding. Anyway, so we are talking about the topic of karma. We started last week. And karma is a topic that, for some reason tends to stir up a lot of questions. I think a lot of the question has to do with how can I get it right? How can I not do the wrong thing? Actually, I have to say, I have to confess, I also don't know what is right. I just, when you've asked me, I just, off the top of my head, I tell you what I think about it, yeah. But the problem with karma is that, apart from what, we read about in text, and what we may have heard from other teachers, other people, yeah. There's very little things you can exactly scientifically experiment with karma, especially the Buddhist version of karma, which later I'll talk about. Spend many lifetimes. Many lifetimes. How to do an experiment that spends many lifetimes. These days about doing research. It's very hard to even get money that will last 3 years. 3 years is the maximum, usually 2 years. Because the director needs results for his or her promotion, right? He cannot give you too much money for 5 years. In 5 years, no result, right? And the director cannot be promoted. So, 2 years. Within 2 years, you must give results. Then the director can show his or her boss, see, I have my subordinate has done good research, so you should promote me. But this Buddhist idea of karma spans many lifetimes. And so it becomes something really difficult to verify directly or personally, and it becomes something like we have to take on faith. And I think that in particular makes it quite difficult for us. I used to teach the topic of karma, and I asked people, I'm going to try this exercise. First question I asked, I was teaching in Italy. I was quite nervous at that time. I said, oh my God, teaching karma to Italians in the heartland of Roman Catholicism. It's our response of a guest. So at the beginning of the call, I said, all right, who among you believes in karma? Please raise your hand. Let's try it here, okay? So you decide for yourself whether you want to say you believe or you don't believe in karma. So those of you here who believe in karma, please raise your hand. See? I get the same result in Italy. I was so shocked. I said, well, that made life so easy. You already believe in karma, then I don't have to prove anything. And off I go, I just have to tell them what I think karma is, and that's it. Because the hardest thing, of course, in the topic of karma is if someone to ask you, how do I know this is true? How do I know all those things you blah 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 talk about karma is really true? And I will say, well, not really. It's not much you can do about it unless you have some special power which the Buddha is said to have, whereby you can recollect your own past life. And not only that, but you can also see other people's rebirth. Then you can sort of, with that special ability, which we call clairvoyance, the type of clairvoyance, then you can join the dots. Like you can say, okay, in some donkey years, lifetime ago, I did this. Then I can connect that action at the point to the result like several lifetimes later. Or because I did that, and therefore I experience this result and I can join the dots. You say, oh yeah, yes. But since I don't have that ability, and I don't believe in other people's so-called past life regression. You always have a past life in Egypt. I don't understand why. Like, all souls must go through Egypt before they can come to the modern time. And they always reborn in the upper class of Egypt. I've never had anybody say they have a past life in Egypt as a slave. And then they just die. You know, the rocks fall down and they crush them and they're big. Always some pharaoh or their Cleopatra or their some priest, you know, priestly order of Egypt, right? How come so lucky? So all these people, they have past life regression, end up in some special person in ancient Egypt. So I'm not so trustworthy. I don't trust so much a lot of those experiences that people report from their past life regression. So it goes to show it's quite hard to verify the Buddhist idea of karma in the usual way. So that's also one of my struggles with this topic of karma. Okay, anyway, 7 to 12. Last week I touched on the 4 general characteristics of karma, which I think is a good way to just have an easy way of summarizing the idea of karma. First is that there is a definite relationship between the cause, the actions that are the cause, and their results. A definite relationship. And I didn't go into much detail, but today I'll talk more. We Buddhists, we say there's something called virtuous action, and these actions are conducive to bring about happiness as a result. And there's other types of action called non-virtuous action, and these are conducive to bring about suffering as a result. Okay? And then I thought a bit vague about the whole thing, but at least the main thing in this first general characteristic is there is a definite relationship. You never get mixed up. It's not possible, according to this first characteristic, to do a virtuous action and as a result of that, to experience suffering. Nor is it possible to commit a non-virtuous action and as a result of that action, to experience happiness. So it's definite. Right? So say the teaching. Okay, so this is the first characteristic. Sounds familiar? Yeah. Second one is that even small actions or tiny actions can bring huge results. there are different ways to understand this. One is small, tiny, insignificant action, but repeated cumulatively over a long period of time can have huge impact. But there is also another way, is that sometimes even though we commit an action that we do us seems like a tiny little thing, and yet we can be confronted with a huge result. So small action doesn't necessarily equal small result. Small as in what you may regard it as insignificant, but you don't have to engage in some huge project over a long period of time in order to enjoy or experience equally large results, even small actions. Third characteristic is if we do not create the cause, the actions that are the cause, we will not experience the corresponding results. Right? And the fourth one is actions that we do create, we engage in those actions, they will not be wasted. So even though their result may not be immediately apparent, it doesn't mean that those actions are of no use or they have no impact at all. Okay? Because how actions bring about results are quite complicated. Because our actions interact with other conditions and causes, you know, in order to bring about results, and sometimes it may not be so apparent, and sometimes it may be delayed. You know, and so just because we engage in action and we do not see any effect immediately doesn't mean that that action is ineffective or that action has no impact or no result at all. So these are the four general characteristics. I think it's a lot of it probably common sense, but it's very encouraging. So what it does is it encourages us first to make sure that if we want certain results, we should choose the right causes or conditions to create. Right? Make sure you get it right. No, let's say I want the result of happiness, but I engage in a cause that actually brings suffering. Right? You mustn't be confused about that relationship. Right? So make sure you choose the right causes in order to bring about the result that you desire. This is a very important thing. And if you don't want certain results, then you should abstain from creating the causes. So that is another way of looking at it. Second one is, and do not underestimate little actions like daily life, little things that we do routinely. We may not pay so much attention to them, but nonetheless, they can have huge impact on ourselves and also on the people around us. Right? So the second one comes down to not underestimate what we might consider insignificant action. Small action, right? Small things. Third one is, and to encourage us to, if we want certain results, we should put in energy and attention to create their causes. There's no point wanting certain results but doing nothing about it. Just sit there and just complain or grumble about it. Right? So if we want to see a certain effect of certain results, we must make effort to create their corresponding causes. And the last one is, not to feel that because we engage in certain projects, we make certain choices, even though the effect may not be immediately apparent, it doesn't mean that what we have done are meaningless or purposeless. And it doesn't mean that those actions are wasted. Okay? So these are some of the ideas we can derive from this. I thought as a general introduction to the topic of karma, these four are a good way and good to try to remember them. Or try to at least think about them, see whether you agree with them or not. Sound familiar? Yeah, so that's what we covered last week. And today I want to talk about, I want to focus on the topic of perception. So today I want to connect perception, the idea of perception, protecting us from danger and so on, with the topic of karma. Just previously I talked about refuge, right, and how to going for refuge, establishing our trust in the refuge object that can protect us. Primarily protect our mind, give us something we can entrust our heart, we can place our trust on, and that in turn they can support us. So, what about karma then? And how, what has karma got to do with protection? So, we can look at protection in this case from, at a few different levels in two different ways. But first, we start off with this, idea that the Dalai Lama quite often talk about, is to recognize that each one of us, we have this very natural and instinctive wish, all of us. We all want to be happy, and we don't want to experience suffering. We may define happiness differently, we may define suffering differently. Right? What is happiness to me may be suffering for you, and what is suffering for you may be absolute bliss for me. Okay? So we can define what makes us happy and what makes us suffer quite differently, and we can have different responses. But, in spite of that, all of us, each one of us, that sometimes we look at every sentient being, not just human being, but sentient being, has this instinctive wish seeking happiness and trying to avoid suffering. Okay? And this is, later we'll do meditation on this. This is a very important thing to remember, and I think in our daily life to honor this, to recognize that, oh, actually, deep down within me and deep down within others, all we are trying to do is we are trying our best to be happy. We are trying our best to avoid suffering. So, okay, so that is the baseline. We start from the baseline. And then let's look at what do we do, most of us, what do we normally do? So the first level is, even if we are not religious, just anybody, any one of us, of course we try our best to be happy, right? So we create the causes, we engage in actions, the activity that we feel that this is going to bring happiness to me. And we do whatever we can to avoid suffering, right? So if I say, ice cream, I have some lactose intolerance. So ice cream, which is a bliss to other people, usually cause me quite bad stomach ache. Sometimes in social settings it's very difficult. Oh, ice cream, everybody very excited about the ice cream. I'm not at all excited about the ice cream. Sometimes people are very hard to tell them, I don't actually want the ice cream. But, oh, you must have some. This is really wonderful. So what to do? So this thing that brings bliss to you, is potential source of great suffering for me. And of course, we try our best, I try my best to maneuver it so that I can avoid suffering without offending your source of peace. Okay, so we do this thing instinctively. We engage in actions, we make choices, we all do, right? Regardless of whether we're religious or not, whether we believe in karma or not. We instinctively, try our best to create causes that we feel will bring happiness and avoid those causes from bring us. This is the first level. And this is how we do to protect ourselves. Protect ourselves from suffering and to protect our happiness, our sources of happiness, so that we can take it away. This is the first level of protection every one of us engages. Okay? Don't tell me you don't do that. Okay? That you willingly suffer. And you willingly destroy your happiness. And you felt that I deserve it. No. What we do instinctively at this level. Okay? And we do that to our best ability until we arrive at situations where we, despite our best effort, remain out of our control. We cannot control those situations. For example, not so much in Singapore, Singapore is very lucky. In other countries, there's a lot of natural disasters. It's drought, it's flooding, it's earthquake. This massive disaster, depending on where you are, where you don't have much control over. You're, of course, you'd rather not live in a place where there's earthquake, but sometimes you don't have a choice, right? Earthquake can be very devastating, and when you're in that situation, this is something you can't control, isn't it? And on a more closer to home, then there are accidents. Because we don't like accidents, especially life-threatening accidents. But it's far better, so it's not something we can completely control, because we don't put ourselves in harm's way. But, And so this level of protection, we find that we engage in it, and Buddhists engage in it, especially Tibetan Buddhists. So we seek the protection from uncontrollable situations, things that we cannot rationally or easily control. So we rely on extraordinary measures. You can call it supernatural measures. I give you an example. Many years ago, I think whenever something went wrong, my teacher and a few of us, we were about to travel to India to attend a teaching by the Dalai Lama. And whenever gave up this little grain, I think they are barley grain or wheat, some with husk. And I think it's a very bizarre, reddish orange color. I think they might have soaked it in saffron. Okay, and this grain is very special. They have been blessed by some Tibetan Buddhist ritual, I think involving this figure, this Dhamma Sakyatakong Mahatala, has a special power to prevent your luggage from being lost. So when I was giving, I think I'll add one. Here, put a few of this grain in your luggage. Then it will not be lost. And you may not know, this is one of my items of anxiety. For some reason, I find the thought of losing my luggage, in transit or whatever, but I find it's so unbearable. I will rely on this supernatural measure. I'll carefully keep this few grains in my luggage. And if they stay in that luggage for many years, she says, and do you believe it? I never experienced it. Lost luggage. No? And they continue until the grains themselves disappear. I don't know why I did this. Okay, I changed back on the center. Yeah. So you can appreciate that. So this is protection. Protection for myself against situations that are very unpleasant and yet not entirely under my control. I can't control what they do with my luggage, right? And they're going, if you ever seen how they handle the baggage, especially in India or Nepal, there's some funny procedure that I look like. Looks very dangerous. It will easily be displaced. Yeah. I think in Nepal, I can't remember, this is many years ago now, because things have changed a lot. At one point, we were all asked to disembark the plane and go downstairs to and identify our own luggage. What was the point of it? Then they load it back. So we go out to bring the plane and they load the luggage back. I thought, what's the point of that exercise, right? But the fact they do something like this always helps me. There's always a great danger of being misplaced. So I fear certain things, so I engage in certain things to protect myself from that fear. In this case, that's what I mean by supernatural measure. I always wonder, as you probably should, are those grains effective or not? Right. This is just one tiny example. Right? So in fact, you may say that there's this thing called blessing pot. This is a red string. Sometimes it's multicolored. The different material and you tie it around. I remember it's supposed to be blessed. Yes. You know what they do? They mumble something over it. And it's supposed to protect you from. Also, not sure what it protects you from, but it's good to have it. And the Tibetans are very particular about this. And in fact, I remember one public teaching this in India. The Dalai Lama said, he was saying in Tibetan, but the translator, he said, make sure you get the blessing call to the Tibetan. I know you travel a long distance to get it. Yeah. So this is another type of protection, which we do as ordinary human beings. We do our best to maximize protection. In this case, against things that we cannot control, we can easily control. Other examples would be, in Thailand, they sell this amulet, right? I never quite figure out that, not in Thai Buddhism, but that is very popular, right? A lot of monks are involved in blessing and making those amulets. Those amulets are again a kind of protection. So there is a term for this. These are protection by way of the power of the object. So the objects are viewed as sacred objects. They somehow infuse with special properties, and they guard us, protect us from dangers, things unwanted or unexpected. So there's another level of protection. Sounds familiar, right? We all do it to some extent. Okay? So these two are very common. We see in just among human beings, right? In different cultures, in different religions, you know, where there are human beings, we do these two levels of protection. We do our best. Those things that we can control, we try to control. Those things that we cannot control, we still try to control. Relying on supernatural, extraordinary measures. Okay? But so in Buddhism, now we will look at two other levels of protection. The first level is protection in relation to karma. Okay? Now this you must the Buddhist idea of karma only makes sense within the Buddhist worldview of multiple lives. Okay? Later we'll talk about in a single life, but normally Buddhist idea of karma only makes sense in the multiple lives, not just two or three lives, okay? Quite a lot, right? When I was preparing for this class, I thought, actually 1,000 lifetimes is still too short because there are stories in Buddhism of how you can create either a negative or positive action. And as a result of that single action, you have to take rebirth 500 times. 500 lifetimes, okay? Either a good place or a bad place, that depends on what sort of actions you do. Actually, a very famous story is, it came from Zen tradition. And, I just tell you this story. It's kind of interesting. By a master called Venerable Bai Zhang. Bai Zhang is actually a very famous Zen master. He set down the rules for the Zen monastic community in China. And this story involved Bai Zhang is he was giving public teaching, and he kept observing that during those teachings, this elderly gentleman would appear and attend the teaching, and then after the teaching finished, would disappear. Right? He saw something about that gentleman caught his eye. And then after one particular evening, one teaching, everybody left. This gentleman came forward and introduced himself and talked to him. This was one of those strange stories. This gentleman said, actually, I'm not human. I'm a fox. And many, many years ago, many, many lifetimes ago, I was actually the abbot of the monastery on this same site that we are teaching. And what happened is that at that time, someone came forward and asked him a Dharma question. You know, something to do with the Buddha and karma. Is the Buddha bound or affected by karma? Buddha so special, enlightened. Enlightened really. What happened to the Buddha and his karma? And this elderly gentleman in this life, and this fox actually, you know, at that time as an abbot, gives the answer, oh, Buddha is not bound by karma, not bound by karma. And as a result of saying that one answer, subsequently he was reborn for 500 lifetimes as a fox. And so now, after 500 lifetimes, he appeared in front of Venerable Bai Zhang and said, I'm going to ask you the same question. For Buddha and karma, please give me your answer. Actually, please give me like your insight into this. And Bai Zhang said, oh, Buddha is not deluded by karma. And then all Zen stories, suddenly a dear old fox has an enlightenment experience. He awakens and says, oh, so that's the answer. And then he said, okay, so my wish is fulfilled. Please, and that means he's enlightened. He can now be liberated from this fox river. He said, please, next tomorrow, please go to the hill behind the monastery and look for my body and please kindly give it a monastic burial. Then he disappeared. And so Bai Zhang the next day called his disciples and they all went to the back of the hill and they found the corpse of the fox. He gave a monastic burial for this fox. So, of course, it's a Zen koan, one of those funny stories where you are asked to meditate on it and say, well, the question is, what's the difference between the two answers? is the Buddha, why the Buddha, saying the Buddha is bound, not bound by karma, earn you 500 lifetimes as a fox, and saying that the Buddha is not deluded by karma, earn you liberation from a fox rebirth. I don't know why I talk about this, but so karma, and we'll come back to this story about karma and the Buddha, karma and liberation. So, there's this 500 lifetimes. So, to fully understand the Buddhist idea of karma and rebirth, you need to look at much longer time, many, many lives, okay? Because some actions that we create in one lifetime, we may experience the result in that very lifetime. Some actions in the next life, the life afterwards. And some, many, many lifetimes later. Okay? So if you were to do a, what I call cosmic accounting, moral accounting, right? You chop all the good actions, bad actions, and then the other side is good result, bad result. You want to account, right? To see whether they tally or not. Then you must count it over many, many lifetimes. But if you just count over one lifetime, you say, hey, it's not fair, you know. I do all these good things, but I die terrible death. Then what about all my good deeds? Or you say, oh, this, look at that person. Such a bad person. Only do negative things. And then you get to enjoy wealth, pleasant, and die peacefully. What about karma? Is this justice in one single lifetime? And they say, hey, this cannot be true. Then the Buddhist will give you an explanation. Look, you must look over 100,000 lifetimes. Then you can see why. See, you, that person who did all these good deeds, not to worry. In some future life, they will ripen. But in that life, unfortunately, this bad deed that he or she has done, that the ex lifetime will therefore die in this tragic manner, full of suffering. And the bad guy, yes, of course, this life is not so bad thing, not to worry. In some future life, he will get his deserved punishment. But long, long time ago, he did this tiny little thing. They usually like to tell you this tiny little thing. They offer a bowl of water to the Buddha out of the ocean. And because of that, you get to enjoy all these wonderful things in this life. It's a bit of a religious marketing and propaganda, telling you that you should make more offerings, you know, when you come to the center. Yeah. So that's why it all works out. Accounting is perfectly fair. Who are many, many lives. Okay? So, I'm just half joking. So that's how you should see the Buddhist idea of karma. Of how so-called virtuous actions bring happiness and non-virtuous actions bring suffering over a long, very extended time. Okay? I'm sure that's what we heard on many occasions in the Buddhist context. Okay? So this is the Buddhist idea of perception. It's very extended. So, and I think actually most Buddhists, although we heard of this and we understood it, it's not really what we want. Right? What we really want is what instinctively we only care about this life. Right? I want it now, this life. So if I'm sick with cancer and then somebody says, oh, you should liberate animals. Oh, I'm very enthusiastic. I go out and buy, you know, what did they buy this day? We used to buy cricket. So that you can buy a lot of cricket with very little money, right? And usually it goes by how many lives you save. So you buy lots and lots of bags of cricket. Usually I think it's fish to bird or fish or something like that. And then you just go and liberate. There's no ecological awareness, okay? You just liberate them. And what do we hope from saving lives, which is a virtuous action? We want it to ripen in this life, so I will recover from my illness and get to live long and happy life. So that is really a lot of us how we understand karma. Because honestly speaking, even for myself, I'm really only concerned about my happiness and suffering of this life. Okay? And so there is a kind of fundamental difference between what we want and what is presented in the future. So far, you're with me. The fourth level of protection it's a Buddhist idea of liberation. No. The Buddha, Buddhists actually think that what we are experiencing, be it a good rebirth or a bad rebirth, is part of what we call cycling existence, samsara, right? We just go round and round and round. Actually, the whole idea of the Buddha teaching is not to help us to have a better time in samsara. No? I sometimes describe it as in samsara is like a bit like in prison. You've been prison, right? And the whole point is not to decorate your prison until it looks like your posh penthouse or that really comfortable while you're in prison. Although I'm sure that happens also like in some part of the world, you know. If you have enough money, you bribe the guards, you can live like a king in prison, right? But the whole idea is to get out of the imprisonment. Yeah. So to get out of this situation of cycling existence, having to think rebirth over and over again. And that's the whole point of really the Buddha teaching, is to set us free from the bondage of our karma. That our karma is partly one of the reasons why we have to keep taking rebirth. Good one or bad one, but we still have to keep coming back over and over again. So the whole idea of the teaching is to set us free from the bondage of karma and also our restricted state of mind. So that is the fourth level of protection. That is really the ultimate protection to achieve a state of complete liberation from suffering and bondage. This is the four levels. Okay? So I thought maybe that fulfilled my commitment to explain the Buddhist idea. But I thought let's be serious, okay? What we really want is to be happy in this life, to not suffer in this life, and to have protection in that case, in that sense, for ourselves and for our loved ones in this life. So let's focus on this more specifically. Let's talk a little bit about that, because I think this is really what we instinctively look for and wish for. And I think we should at least address that. So I look at it in this particular way. So I mentioned before how Buddhism helps us to get happiness. It's not really about helping us to get what we want. Oh, I want this, I want that. And in order to be happy, Buddhism does not actually fulfill all your wishes. Instead, what Buddhism does is it changes our definition of happiness. Okay? So, according to the Buddha, you can describe four types of happiness. So let's see whether this we can resonate with that. Four types of happiness. The first type of happiness, the Buddha says, is happiness of sensual pleasure. It means it comes from stimulating our senses. We like to see beautiful things, something pleasant, sense I see. We like to hear beautiful sound, pleasant sound, you know. Being praised, that's very nice. Keep it coming. So that is pleasant to us. Smell, nice smell, nice taste. Which is why most Singaporeans, we travel from one end of the island to the other end. And we queue up for hours just to have that dish or whatever, chow kway teow or whatever. Yeah. So this is to not punish our taste buds. So these are another type of pleasure. Then the pleasure of touch, tactile sensation. So and also in Buddhism you can include the six. In Buddhism we talk about six senses, which includes the mind. So six senses of the mind is in terms of thinking, remembering. Things that stimulate the mind. Okay? So, for example, let's say I like to read. Reading a novel, although reading is a visual thing, but actually what happens is because of the words, it stimulates my mind. I imagine, it stirs up my thoughts, you know, my feelings. So there is that enjoyment of that mental stimulation. So that also comes under the happiness of sensual pleasure. Good? Is happiness? I mean, don't be too aesthetic. Don't deprive yourself of good old sensual pleasure. Okay. So this is the first type of happiness. Second type of happiness, the Buddha talk about happiness of blamelessness. So we don't usually talk much about this. Blamelessness means freedom from blame. Actually, what it means, you have a clear conscience. You have no regret. You don't suffer from guilt over things that you have done. You feel perfectly, how should I say, guilt-free. That's it. And it's a wonderful sense of, it's actually it's very unusual, but it's a wonderful sense of wholesomeness that you know you have done your best, you have not intentionally tried to hurt or harm anybody. Right? And so it related to ethics. Yeah. And so there is a sense of wholeness, wholesomeness within yourself. So this is also a type of happiness of blamelessness. Maybe you can understand it if you look at the reverse of how someone can really suffer out of some regret in their life, out of some guilt, or they're tormented by things that they have done which they deeply regret. And that torment, sometimes some of those deeds that we've done, we cannot go back and make amends. We can't change it. What's done is done. And there are people who are tormented for their life, not the life of guilt. So that is a particular type of suffering. So maybe that can help you to appreciate the happiness of blamelessness. This is the second part. The third part of happiness, in Buddhism, we talk about happiness of meditative absorption. Okay? Absorption means your attention is fully engaged with whatever it is. Meditative, I like to put the word meditative because it can go very, very deep. Of course, most of us, we can experience some degree of absorption. There is this phenomenon called flow in psychology, where under certain circumstances, you are very engaged in what you're doing. Usually, it has to do with some kind of performance, or you are involved in some sport, and you get very engaged in doing it. All your attention are focused on it. And it's a very wonderful state to be in, to find that your attention is, you're not distracted, you are able to fully give your attention to whatever it is you are engaged in or doing. And you have this wonderful sense of well-being that come out of it. But this can go much deeper in meditative context. So much so that people can sit and be very happy and contented and completely at peace with themselves. And 1 or 2 hours can pass and you don't feel the passing of time. And the mind feels so serene, so tranquil, so at peace. So it's a wonderful state of happiness, a special type of happiness, happiness of meditative absorption. This is the third type of happiness that we just talk about. Okay? And the last type of happiness is the happiness of liberation type. This is the unusual kind of happiness. So the first three types of happiness, we call them conditional happiness, because they depend on conditions. Sensual pleasure depends on certain objects, right? Like, let's say if you enjoy music, it depends on music for you to enjoy it. Or you like the touch, it depends on someone giving you the touch. I always say, I enjoy massage, but I always say, it's not worth the money because I tend to undo it immediately. Immediately, once the massage finished, I can feel my tension coming back already. So I'm still lying on the massage table. Poor me. I couldn't even stay relaxed beyond getting out of the massage table. So it's not going to be too mindful. Mindful and then you realize, oh, I think that tension is coming back. And that one is tensing up again. Sensual pleasure. I think it's a blamelessness also depends on condition. Condition is that you do not create actions that you subsequently regret. And happiness of meditative adoption of meditative contemplation definitely depends on condition. You need a certain condition before you can enter into that state of adoption. And that can be disrupted, of course. So these are conditional happiness. And the fourth type, happiness of liberation, or nirvana in Buddhism, is an unconditional happiness. This is very hard to describe. What does it mean? It means you can be happy. It does not depend on any condition at all. How wonderful it is. That is always available. It doesn't depend on conditions. That is, of course, and then go of this practice. I'm going to say more about this later, but so these are the four types of teaching. And I think we can experience all four in this way. I'm very optimistic. For pessimists, I'm very optimistic. We can have happiness of sensual pleasures, which we already have. We can have happiness of blamelessness. Maybe we will do it that well, but if we are careful and mindful, we can avoid a major mistake. And so we do not create harm, especially to those that we love, and we care about, so we can increase the chance of having this sense of blamelessness, this sense of a clear conscience. Happiness of meditative absorption, this is a bit hard. You need to meditate. You get over the excuse of, I haven't been meditating in a long time. Yeah. This is what you need to work on it. Okay? And I also think that this is possible for us in this very life to also experience unconditioned happiness. Okay? So if we can achieve this four, then we have very kind of very good protection. Okay? If you're happy, you can be suffer. And the way to achieve this form is, of course, to engage in the right kind of action, to do the things that are actually causes or conditions for this kind of happiness. So this is how I define virtuous action. So if I say virtuous actions are what are conducive for happiness, then you can ask me, what are virtuous actions? What are wholesome? And so one way I personally how I understand it is virtues of wholesome action should be actions that is based on wisdom. Wisdom that really understands reality or truth correctly. So that I know, okay, if I do this, this will be the result. And if I do that, that is, I have a correct understanding of reality. I'm not deluded. And I really understand what is an important different relationship. And that is very much to do with wisdom. In Buddhism, wisdom is really learning how to, learning about the cause and effect relationship. What are the causes that I need to create in order to experience the corresponding result? And learning what are the causes I should not create in order to not experience wisdom. So virtuous action must be based on wisdom, based on correct understanding. But that's not enough. You see. But quite often when people sometimes with this idea that if you think like this, it can be very analytical. Do this, that, that, do this, that, that, don't do this, that, that. It can come across as very cold, right? All very analytical and very mechanical. Actually, virtuous action, on top of that we need a positive motivation. Usually I describe we need motivation kindness. So we not only do we need to know what are the right thing to do, but we also must be able to do it out of kindness. I call this a warm heart and a cool head. Just a cool head can come across as very cold, right? Like some AI like that. Okay, in order to save one you must die. Okay, then you go. You're dead. Right? So actually we know of modern psychology is that actually, unlike this idea of cold rationality, actually human beings, we make decisions, we make choices. Our choices and decisions actually involve our emotions, not just rationality. To make correct choices, we actually need to involve not just rational thinking, but also our emotions. But you see, our emotions are what give us, allow us to tell what is important and what is not important. Our emotions are where we and locate our value, what is important to me, important to us, and that inform my decision. So it's not just all mechanical analysis. So among all the emotional states, I like to think of it as, although there are many positive emotions, but I like to think of it, maybe you all start from kindness. I really like this. So wisdom and kindness together, when we, whatever action we do, out of these two, out of wisdom, out of the motivation of kindness, then I call that virtuous action. It can be virtuous action, physical action, actually doing something, it could be out of speech, it could be just in your mind, the thought that we dwell on and think about. So this is our virtual function. And so I'm saying, so we engage in this virtual function, then they are predicted on the student's habits, the four types. Do you think it's true? Do you think maybe there's some exception? Yes. 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 Yeah. So when you're angry, don't do anything. Of course, no. Of course, ideal is you always be able to act out of wisdom and kindness. But of course, in reality, that's not always true, right? We are overwhelmed by different emotions, triggered by different emotions, and we tend to act out of it. Right? And my personal way of looking at it is, and when we do find, because we can't control ourselves, right? The words already came out of my mouth. Out of anger, right? So we can learn from it. Since we do it, so we can learn by paying attention and to see, like, for example, usually I don't notice it, I'm not that mindful of this argument. Then after that entire argument, I sat down somewhere and thought, maybe I shouldn't say that. Okay? So I can look back. And I can look back and see, the whole situation. What started it off and how I react to it and what are the consequences, the immediate consequences of my actions. And then I can learn from it. I can learn that, oh, I react out of anger. And I don't like the experience of anger. I don't like the experience of acting out of anger. And I don't like the result of my actions based on anger. And that is one way we are teaching ourselves. So we imprint that on our mind. I actually am not happy about the whole incident. So every time you do it, what you are doing is, even though I cannot stop myself before I spoke out of anger, I can subsequently undermine this idea that acting out of anger is good. I'm sort of piling up evidence against it, so that maybe the next time I find myself in a similar situation, I might be able to check myself in time and say, look, keep your mouth shut. Don't say, last time I really regret bursting out anger. It doesn't help me. I really hate the result of it. So I might be able to stop myself. And so then I change my karma. I create a different action. Is that what I'm saying? Yeah, of course. Yeah. So what we have done, we spill the milk, then we spill the milk. We cannot get back. But that doesn't mean that we cannot do anything about it. So at least I learn from it. I learn from my past mistakes, and I try this time to do it differently. I think, especially in the topic of karma, always people like to say, how can I rewind? Go and erase it, you know, as if it didn't happen. Unfortunately, it's not such thing. Rewinding, you know. We like it, you see, we like, can I start all over again? Yeah, didn't do very well, start over again, can you just erase everything? And then I start, unfortunately, life didn't happen like this, life only moves forward, it doesn't kind of move backward. So all we can do at any point of time is to recognize, oh, what we have done, maybe we learn our past, and we do our best again in the future. So I think in the topic of karma, just in a very simple way, just looking even of this, in this life, my feeling, my way of thinking is that how can I protect myself based on this teaching of karma? The more I am convinced the relationship between my actions that I've done, virtuous actions based on wisdom, whatever wisdom I have, which is not perfect, whatever kindness I can find within myself, and the more I do this action, the more I'm contributing to my experience of happiness in this life. Maybe also future life, but more dislike happiness, both in terms of happiness of sensual pleasures, happiness of blamelessness, happiness of meditative absorption, and maybe I also contribute to achieving the happiness of liberation. First of all, when you're in a good mood, you enjoy pleasure, sensual pleasure much better. Try to enjoy sensual pleasure when you're very angry. You can't drive, or when you're very worried, you can't drive. But whereas your mind is peaceful, you're at ease, you're in a good mood, you're full of loving kindness. You enjoy sensual pleasure so much more. And also, when we add our kindness and wisdom the best we can manage, we reduce the chances of us causing harm. Therefore, we reduce the chances of feeling guilt, regret, having a bad conscience. So we enhance the happiness of blamelessness. And the more you add our wisdom and kindness, the more our mind becomes subdued, mind becomes softer, more pliable. And therefore, when you meditate, you find that meditation goes smoother. You try to meditate when you are very, very stressed, you are very, very angry, you are very, very upset about something. You find that it's almost, which is why a lot of people abandon meditation. The mind is, in Buddhism, we call it unsubdued. The mind has just gone mad. You find that mind, if you're angry, the mind keeps going round and round and round and round about issue. You're very worrying about something. You go on and on, but you can't do anything about the mind. You can't calm the mind down in meditation. So this is that unsubdued mind. Unsubdued mind, you don't experience the happiness, meditative concentration. Whereas the mind, when the mind is filled with loving kindness, the mind is able to add our wisdom. And you find that meditation is bliss. It's okay. You sit down and meditate, and then your mind settles down very easily. Because it has a very good condition, very conducive our meditation. So it contributes to the happiness of meditative concentration. And we can experience it in this life. That's the way I'm doing the next life. You don't have to believe me to say, or in three lifetimes down the road, you will see the result. You can experience it. Isn't that wonderful? And I think that's what we really want. Right? I just only speak for myself. That's why I become a Buddhist. I want to be happy in this life. I want to stop, I want to stop being miserable in this life. That was my prime motivation that called me to meditate and then called me to learn about Buddhism. I was very miserable. I didn't know. I was a teenager. We always think that our misery is the worst in the entire universe, that no one is more miserable than us. And so that started me on the journey of meditation. And I still think so. Many years now, I've studied Buddhism for more than 30 years. Yeah, a lot of different ideas and theories. Let me finish this one. Looking back, I still go back to my initial meditation. I actually really want to not be so miserable in this life. That was my prime motivation. And I kind of go back and honor that. And I find that it makes things so much easier. Mm-hmm. Then of course it would be good if I have more noble motivation. Oh, I would say all sentiment and suffering. Not bad. I usually forget about all sentiment. I only think about myself. Okay? But at wherever I am, I find that if I try to fulfill that, then things sort of make more sense to come together better. Yes,
in this life, we are always thinking that when we are dying, we have to the last stop moment. Can we be aware of the last stop moment before we get to the next stop?
Can you be aware of that? I doubt I will be. I'm the sort of people that sleep and go on right. So I don't have any experience in this life where I'm aware of my mind rising into complete unconsciousness. So my chances are not good at the time of death for me to catch the last moment. Actually, to be safe, don't wait until the last moment. Okay? Because what happens if you miss, then, oh, sorry, you have to wait for another life. So what we talk is that let's say dying, right? You should start in the earliest possible time to start to cultivate a virtuous mind and try to sustain virtuous mind. So much so that you hope that the momentum of it will carry you to the very last moment and beyond. Which is why there's this practice of doing practices that the dying person is familiar with at the deathbed next to them while they're dying, to help them in doing this practice. A common one in Chinese Buddhism is, especially if you know the person beside Amitabha Buddha's name, right? For 住念, you help to recite. So you recite the same mantras or same prayers next to the dying person. And so much so that it's like a reminder of that. So even in their state of whatever level of consciousness, that sound, that practice can remind them and enable them to follow along with that practice. So and that helps to ensure that they have a virtuous state of mind while dying, and hopefully practice it in the moment. Of course, you must make sure you choose the right practice. Don't choose one that says, oh no, this is my fear.
Please stop. I really hate that prayer.
Please stop saying that to me. Yeah. Then you will cause, you will disturb the dying person's mind. They get irritated. Right. And that is not a good way to die. It's an unpleasant way to die. So, according to Buddhism, not so helpful for your future life. Anyway, don't worry about my religion. I always have all these different ideas. People will say, oh, this is very common to Tibetan Buddhist tradition. So, some years ago, when the Lama, we know, he was passing away. And so, he was home. And so what happened is a lot of the students take turns to do familiar practices that they've been doing next to his bedside. As a way of, and my friend was telling me that, this is not when he was really dying, but he was quite ill. Occasionally, he shows signs that he's able to follow those practices that they are doing. So that's the idea that you do a practice to remind the person of their own virtuous practice so that they can bring that to mind and that ensure that they have a really practice state. So I think that's my very simplistic way of talking about connection in terms of karma. I want to say a little bit about unconditional happiness. So unconditional happiness means it doesn't depend on conditions, which means it is always available. Okay? Now unconditional happiness by definition cannot be created by conditions. So how does being engaging in a virtuous action, living a virtuous action, how does that contribute to us experiencing the happiness of liberation from nirvana? So what it does is it doesn't create the happiness of liberation. All it does is create a kind of favorable condition for us to discover, make it a little bit easier for us to discover the happiness of liberation for ourselves. Okay? But those conditions does not create the happiness of liberation. It just simply creates a platform whereby what we stand on it becomes a bit easier for us to discover unconditional happiness, to discover happiness and liberation. I always find this very encouraging because the myth, you don't actually have to be a good person in order for you to discover happiness and liberation for yourself. But quite often in this circle, I hear people say, oh, I can never achieve nirvana, I can never achieve it. I'm not good enough. I'm not a good person. And therefore, I cannot hope to achieve nirvana, the goal of liberation from suffering. And I always thought that was very depressing, very pessimistic. Even for a pessimist, that is too pessimistic. Okay? I like this idea that there's no such thing as you have to be good enough in order for you to be liberated. You don't have to be good enough in order for you to discover this so-called unconditional happiness. I like the idea that even you are very bad person, you've always done all these bad things. But under certain circumstances, you might chance upon, you might have a glimpse of this unconditional happiness. And isn't that wonderful? you don't have to give up on yourself, even though you might be able to be doing a lot of good things. It's not without hope. So, after you attend my class, don't ever say such things. I'm not a good person, and therefore I cannot achieve. Unconditional happiness doesn't depend on conditions. So it is still available, regardless of who you are. So long as you are able to and things come together, catch a glimpse of it. And then on that basis you can expand on it. And then you can actually find this kind of unconditional happiness. There's a classic story in Buddhism about a disciple of the Buddha called Angulimala. Angulimala is a serial killer by modern standards. He killed 999 human beings and chopped off their finger, I don't know which finger, and make a garland of fingers and ward it around him. I thought 999 fingers are pretty lot, right? That would be a very long garland to be able to look around. Garland of fingers, Angulimala. I think that's the, his name is actually Angulimala, garland of fingers. He's a serial killer. And he decided to make the Buddha his last victim, the thousandth person. And so there, as the story goes, that he saw the Buddha, he gave chase. The Buddha just walked. It's supernatural. No matter how hard Angulimala ran and ran and ran, the Buddha just walked leisurely in front, but he can never catch him. The Buddha just walked, and he was always faster than him. Supernatural. So finally, Angulimala said, "Stop! Stop! Which is a funny thing, right? Yeah, you are trying to kill someone and you are asking your victim to stop running away. Then the Buddha stopped and turned around and said, "I have already stopped. What about you?" This is one of those Zen stories. Then Angulimala has an epiphany and realized something. And then he stopped. He dropped his knife and he converted to a victim. Marvelous, isn't it? How you can stop a serial killer from murdering you. But anyway, and because of that encounter with him, he changed his way completely, turned over a new leaf. And then afterwards, after received more teaching for the Buddha, he subsequently achieved the final goal of arahatship, liberation, in that very lifetime. And this is after you have murdered 999 human beings. Okay? And because he was ordained, he escaped the law. Because at that time, in that kingdom, you wouldn't be tried for the crime if you become a monastic. The monastic community grants you a certain kind of protection in the law. Is anyone who can kill 999 persons? Don't have to go to jail or don't have to be, don't have to suffer the death penalty, and you achieve complete liberation from suffering. Voila, you can't be as bad as Angulimala, right? So even he has a chance to achieve liberation in that very life. That's why I say there's no such thing as I'm not good enough to achieve liberation. And it's all because the liberation we talk about in Buddhism is not dependent on conditions, it's not dependent on you being good enough. Actually, what it does is that's how I understand liberation. It actually involves a shift in your perspective. So previously, we are taught in a certain perspective. We look at things in a certain way. We get stuck in it. We think in a certain way, we feel in a certain way, and we act in it. We are very, very stuck. Okay? Liberation involves something as simple as shift. You shift out of that old perspective and discover a new perspective. I think, oh, the world looks so different and yet the same. And from that new perspective, an entirely different way of life unfolds. You have a different, entirely different experience, and you have a different way of acting. And that is liberation. It's as simple as that. A shift. Not so difficult about it. So, it's very possible for us. So long as you can achieve that shift, then something new possibilities open up for you. So that is unconditional. Any questions? That's all the things I want to say about the topic of perception and karma. I hope it makes some sense. I hope I didn't confuse you a bit. No, it's not. It's not conceptual. Of course, we talk about it as conceptual, but the actual experience. Oh, that was way too pessimistic. In order to escape it, we have to stop thinking. I think even within a human form, human body, we can achieve liberation. Of course, I understand what I say. My idea of liberation may not be the same as your idea of liberation, but my idea of unconditional happiness is something also available. Even while we are human. No need to be deathbed. Why wait until you're dead, right? Or dying, right? When you're alive and kicking, you can experience it. Isn't that wonderful? Why must you wait? That's also one of the common things. Why must you wait until you're dying to achieve nirvana? And why must you be dead in order for you to achieve nirvana? The Buddha achieved enlightenment, nirvana, and walk around for 45 years. It is the state. Yes. Yes. You can get off it. You can get off the roller coaster. And? Huh? Yes, there is. There is. And it's more obvious than you realize it. They always say it's hidden in the obvious. I mean, you don't have to believe me, but. And that's what I've been trying, to say is that it's not that hidden, it's not that difficult. All it takes is a shift. Seeing things a little bit differently. And then, voila, a whole new world unfolds in front of your eyes. Yeah, no. Oh yeah, I mean, but Buddhists would say that we carry our past karma in our mindstream. We carry it somewhere, right? You go from one life to another, and then you carry it. And since you cannot carry your body with you, then of course Buddhists have no choice but to say, well, somewhere inside your mind, and they will find, okay, and you keep all these past actions and karma. There are a few different versions of how Buddhists get around this, but yeah, it follows you, follows consciousness. Stream of consciousness. One last moment. Is that what you're asking? That's easy, right? Man. Or is it subjective, is it?
Yeah,
maybe we can say it this way, but maybe I create some good karma in the past life, and in this life it manifests as I'm rewarded with some happiness. In my case, the happiness is Amazon gift certificate. Wonderful. You can buy more books. Okay. So it manifests as that. Maybe another person can manifest in a very different form. So, in both cases, we experience certain pleasures that come out of it. So that pleasure is like, the result of some good karma. But the form, the precise form of that pleasure may vary from one person to another. So what gives me pleasure may not give you pleasure. So when your good karma ripens, you're ripened in a form appropriate to your experience. It allows you to experience pleasure. that kind of pleasant experience, which may not be undaunting. Oh, yeah, that's why I hate karmic explanation of all these things. That kind of, I think that kind of interpretation can be dangerous. You think you can say anything under the sun, right? You can explain anything in any other way, right? Then this person will say, oh, it could come by that. I mean, I don't know about that specific incident, but let's say, let's say I don't really enjoy that. I don't derive any pleasure from that change. Right? So how can, maybe for me, it's not necessary the right karma. You know what I mean? Like for this person, let's say, okay, person X died. And then my friend said, oh, person X has been tormenting you. So now that you say, it's your good karma, right? You're free from the torment. Yeah, free from bondage. But then I say, well, maybe not, you know. But that could be his bad karma rather, not my good karma rather, but his bad karma rather. That's why he's dead at this moment, isn't it? So that's why I don't like this kind of so-called karmic explanation. Because there's no standard you can gauge about. It's really up to your limits of your imagination, you know, whether how you interpret a particular happening. And that's why I try not to give karmic explanation. But to give the karmic explanation implies that I can see the cause and effect relationship. I can see the death of this person and relate it back to some past karma that he has created or I have created, and say, look, this is the ripening of your good karma. That's why this person is dead. But I know most of us don't have that ability. We cannot see into past life. We definitely cannot see into that kind of, we can't see that kind of cause and effect relationship, right? So it's all based on our imagination, based on what we, how we feel about that situation, and then we impute, we say, oh, that is good, therefore it must be the result of your good karma. Oh, that's bad, that must be the result of your bad karma. But there's no standard, there's no way of verifying it. So it's really like, that's why I say this sort of karmic explanation is the cheapest thing in the whole universe. You can just made it up and you can, if it doesn't suit you, I can create a new explanation all over again. So there's no, absolutely no way to check which explanation is true or correct and which one is wrong. You know, I'm getting this. Yeah, for giving this kind of karmic explanation, which a lot of people like to do, especially in the Buddhist culture. Oh, this, you know, you suffer so much under the hand of this person. You must have owned this person lots of debt in your previous life. In this life, you are paying back. And then people buy this kind of information. I mean, I don't know if it could be anything, right? Why this particular kind of sob story? You know? So, I don't put too much effort into this. Yes.
Not sure how to put it. From what I understand from the book of Shri, this field of teaching, okay, the karma to me, like the definition of the four items, okay, the direct relationship of the action with the person, okay, and small action, small karma,
can
have a bit
effect.
When you don't create certain
causes, you will not
experience. You will not get certain reaction.
Yeah.
And also, your action created definitely will have results. Eventually.
No, I didn't have the word definitely.
Will have results. Okay.
Yeah, may have results. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, to me, it makes sense because if we look at it, from scientific point of view, example like energy cannot be created. It only can transform from one energy source to another.
So to me, it's like karma is like a seed. Where if I plant a seed, the seed will definitely grow. Yeah, it depends on the
condition. That's right.
Yeah, so that's why then the small seed might grow to be a pumpkin or a big oak.
Yeah.
So that
I think it's a different kind of seed. Yeah. Okay.
And because of the condition,
that's right. Yeah.
It will ripen, it might not ripen. So, we don't know what
seed and plant
seed is.
True, yeah.
And what happens when it ripens.
That's right.
What we can see is that in this life, we try to plant good seed.
Mm, that's right.
Hope that it will be ripened.
Yeah, that's
right. Yeah. If we keep on thinking that why that person have good ripening and not having good ripening, nobody can answer that because we are not
students. Yes.
Yeah.
That's right, because there are many things that we don't know, many things we cannot predict. And sometimes some of this common explanation that people get involved in, I mean, they serve certain function on a certain level, but beyond that, sometimes it's just anybody's guess why this is happening like that. Any other questions? No, I don't confuse you with my explanation of karma. But anyway, yeah, go on. A cultural bias. I don't think so. I don't think so. Especially from people who self-proclaim that they believe in karma. Of course, I don't believe that. Because I think what happens is when people say they believe in karma, they all have their own individual version of karma. Even among Buddhists, even Asian Buddhists, we all have our own understanding of this concept of karma. And it's not homogeneous. They all have slightly different, we understand it in our own particular way. So I don't think there's a very significant cultural difference in terms of this topic of karma, which makes life very easy. Don't have to prove it right. But that is really the hardest thing on the topic of karma. People ask, how do I know that's true? I don't know. You believe it? You don't believe it, then you don't believe it. But regardless of what, back to what I was saying, we nonetheless in our day-to-day life, even without bringing the concept of karma, we have this, what I talk about, the first level of perception, we naturally think that there are certain things we do bring certain results, which is why we do, right? I was joking that this is why there's this long queue outside this Toto and 4D, right? Very good business, because we all believe if you don't buy the number, 100% you will never strike. Okay? Right? But if you buy, you have a chance of getting happiness. That's the firm belief. So we do have on our individual level certain understanding of cause and effect. And basically karma is really the cause and effect. Yes, and I encourage, although I usually have nothing to do with optimism, I encourage you to think of karma in a forward-looking way. Quite often people, when it comes to the topic of karma, they are backward-looking. They always want to know why. Why is this happening to me? Why? What's the point? There's nothing you can do about it. You really think it's already happened. But instead, I think the topic of karma should be forward-looking and say, where I want to be, what do I want to accomplish, what do I want to experience now and in the future. It don't have to be only in the future, now. Then I can say, what can I do now to make that happen? So my choices now can affect my experience the very next moment and can also affect my future experience. And this is a very positive thing. And this is what the teaching of karma and so on. Regardless of what has already happened, what have you already done, and what has already ripened, so what are the conditions that you find yourself in, at any moment, you can create new karma. You can plant new seeds. And those will bring new results. And so if I want a different result, I create a different concept. So if I want any one of those happiness or sensual pleasures, happiness or blamelessness, happiness, meditative adoption, happiness, liberation, then I just have to define what are the appropriate causes and conditions, and I just create them. And then when the conditions are right, that happiness will appear. So very, very positive, isn't it? Very upward looking, forward looking. And I think this is really the power of the karma teaching design. This is real perception. The one that always look back and ask why? Because, you know, up to a certain extent, we human beings, we want to make sense of our experience. We want to be able to rationalize and explain why is this happening. So, but to that extent, maybe karma, some of this karma teaching might help. But nonetheless, that is backward looking. Backward looking is not very effective. We can't change the past. So, maybe after a certain extent, some of this karmic explanation can put our doubt or put our distress to rest. But then after that, we must look into the future. We must say, okay, so from this point on, what is it that I need to do? What are the causes and conditions I need to create in order for me to bring about whatever future I want? What other alternative other than that? Why am I speaking? Why am I speaking from that perspective? Yeah. There are different ways to present enlightenment and liberation. Yeah. So maybe the way I present it is a bit unusual. It's based on this idea of, you can say it's based on this idea of Buddha nature, this belief, this sense of conviction that each one of us, we have within us the potential to be liberated, to be a Buddha. You can say from that point of view, so therefore it is accessible. So we can actually find this unconditional happiness. That's why I say it's hidden in the obvious. It's available, it's accessible, it's actually always available, it's always here and now, but we are a bit obscure. We don't know. First of all, we don't know to look for it, then we don't know where or how to look for it. That's why it's not available. I haven't encountered the teachings, and we receive some teachings, and we create some conditions, then it might be possible for us to chance upon it. Say, oh, so we have a kind of, then we call it enlightenment. We have a glimpse of it. Then that changes a lot. That changes your whole outlook. That says, then it becomes, then the practice becomes one of going back into it and familiarizing ourselves with it. Maybe, not saying it so clearly. Another way of looking at this so-called unconditional habit in this developing Buddhist context is think of it as realization of emptiness. You're maybe familiar with that term, to realize, directly realize emptiness? It's not original, I didn't invent it, but the way I look at it is that, we can think about this whole issue of nirvana in a more kind of user-friendly way. Instead of always thinking that nirvana is but when they are dead, in order to be nirvana or deathbed or it's something not for me, you know, some future life. Why not think of it in a different way, a more encouraging way, a more empowering way, and to bring it closer to us. And maybe actually nirvana is available, it's possible. Although not easy, but and the way to look at it is to think of maybe what nirvana involves is really a profound shift in the way you can say we see things or things appear to us. And there is a phrase in Mind Only School of Buddhist Philosophy, this particular one of those different types of Buddhist philosophy. There's a phrase, and it describes nirvana or liberation as the turning around at the feet of our consciousness. I don't know whether, so it's like you're sitting on one of those swerving chairs. You know? So normally we are stuck in this position and we look out of the world from this angle, right? But what happens if you turn the chair, that's why the seat of consciousness, you turn the chair, and then suddenly the view transforms to different view, right? And that's all it takes. It's just that you swivel your chair around. And then you see things differently and you say, oh, so silly of me, all those anguish and all those suffering, all over nothing. So stupid. You know, I'm going to spend the rest of my life really enjoying this new view, this new perspective. So that's how I see it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Unwavering karma. the name is very deceptive. Unwavering means it doesn't change into something else. Sometimes it doesn't kind of actually what it actually refers to is in meditation you achieve a level of meditative absorption called formless realm or form realm. You achieve what they call jhana. I don't know whether you heard of this jhana or dhyana. And there are 8 levels of them. There are 4 that belong to what we call a form realm. And there's another 4 higher up for the formless realm. So once you experience in your meditation, as I said, you reach this level, you achieve that level of concentration, then that in itself creates a karma, plants a seed. Right? And then when you die, and when that seed ripens, it ripens in a rebirth. In actually, there is a realm somewhere, I don't know where it is, as a form realm god. Okay? So you actually, so meditation can get you into a particular rebirth. So you achieve a formless realm meditation, then when you die, not necessarily in this life, but when it ripens, then you get born in that particular realm of existence. Right? It's actually very boring because just as in meditation, you are constantly in absorption. So when you are born in, let's say, especially the formless realm, your entire life is spent in absorption. And some people say, what's the point of the whole thing? Right? And you have very, very long life spent, especially the formless realm. Like for example, there's one level called the adoption into infinite space. Yeah. There's only space, infinite space. So there's your experience in meditation. When you're reborn there, there's also your experience in that life. You just enter into the adoption for a very long time of infinite space. In fact, they say you have only 2 thoughts. The first is when you're born, you have this thought, oh, I'm born here. Okay. So you enter into adoption. And then you're at the point of death, you have another thought, oh, I'm dying from this. And that's it. That's your entire life spent in meditative absorption. And that karma bring about this rebirth is called unwavering karma. Because it doesn't change into something else. So if you have a karma to be reborn in formless realm, then when you ripen, it will be a birth in formless realm. It doesn't become something else. It doesn't sort of downgrade or upgrade. You just stay like that. It's unwavering. No, no, not forever. No rebirth in Buddhism is forever, but for a very, very, very long time. which it doesn't really matter because anyway you're in absorption. So it's like here when you have a good meditation, 1 hour can pass and you say, oh, I thought it's just 5 minutes. So I don't know why you want to reborn that, but you know, your life will pass as if it's just 5 minutes, but in actual fact maybe 100,000 years has already passed by. Yeah. So that is one type of rebirth, yeah. And usually Buddhists we don't recommend people to strive for that kind of rebirth, because what's the point? All you do in that entire life is you stay in meditation. You know? It's sort of, I mean, in a way, yeah, you don't suffer, but then you also you don't have fun, right? You just stay in adoption. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, so as I said, Tama has more questions, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, so that without time, so that concludes this course on protection via true refuge and karma. I hope I gave you some ideas of this topic and some of it might be useful. As I said, you know, don't worry too much about remembering. What you forget, you forget. And what you remember, you know. That's the easiest way to do it. Yeah. Whatever left behind, whatever you can remember, I really encourage that maybe you can think about them sometime and reflect on it, and maybe if it's something you find is reasonable or appropriate, then maybe we can try to put it into practice. So I'm going to disappear for 1 month. In July I'm going on holiday, and then I start again in August on Tuesday evening with a new topic. And I cannot remember what I have planned. I gave some complicated names, which I think might be attractive to people. But I start again in August. Okay. Thank you very much for your attention.